know, the biggest part of elk hunting is the actual recovery after you shoot one, you know, trying to find it. And there's just a lot of lessons I felt like I could have learned early on without that loss and heartache. So I joined an organization called Oregon Bow Hunters Association and got involved and got on the board and was actually trying to campaign to make it mandatory bow hunter education in Oregon. And just a lot of people look at that like, oh, you're making me do this and I don't want to. And for me, it was more like, no, you should do this because it's going to save you a lot of heartache in the long run. We don't know as much as we think we know. You know, and we don't know what we don't know, right? Through all of my time with the crew there, like, that's why we were successful, because it wasn't, you know, when it came down, there were other issues, but when it came down to hunting and killing elk, it was all about the team effort. And whoever was up, everybody did their part to make sure that person was successful. And by up, I mean the shooter. Everybody was on the bandwagon to get that person a shot and help them kill an elk. I've seen that in hunted with other people here and there throughout time, and that isn't always the case. And some people get greedy and some people want to be the hero, and
sure,
usually that doesn't end up well. I think one of the biggest mistakes made in the woods is guys have a tendency to overthink things. And there are some absolutes, or there's some, not absolutes, but there are some things that are like, if you do this, this is going to happen. Like, if an elk smells you, it's probably over, you know?
Yeah.
Not 100%, but it's probably like 95% that you're done. But for all intents and purposes, like, things change and you overthink things. And at the end of the day, they're a wild animal. And they do remember things, but in the short term. So it's overthinking things has saved a lot more elk than it's killed. If you're hunting where you think elk should be and they're not there, and there are wolves there, start looking in the country where the sheep and goats should be, you know?
Right, yeah.
Steep, gnarly, bluffy stuff that helps them escape the wolves.
Hey guys, welcome to 2024. Thank you for all the years of support. Been at this a long time, and appreciate you sticking with me. And if you're a new listener, thank you for tuning in. If you could help me out by going to iTunes or Spotify and leaving us a review, I really appreciate it. It helps me keep this free. Speaking of keeping this free, check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Use promo code JohnStallone to save 20% on everything that they have. And lastly, if you could, do yourself a favor, help protect hunting, help protect your heritage, and get involved with Howl for Wildlife. That's Howl, H-O-W-L, for wildlife.org. Go check it out, get involved. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we are going to talk about elk and elk hunting, and I got Ty Stubblefield on with me, and gonna pick his brain a little bit and see what he has to say about some of these questions we got, and maybe hear a story or two. What's going on, man?
Hey, John, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for being on. Appreciate you. Why don't you just give us a little rundown about yourself and what you do and where you come from and all that good stuff.
Sounds good. Little bit of history. I started elk hunting when I was in high school. I started rifle hunting and knew nothing about hunting. I didn't grow up in a hunting household, single mom kind of scenario, and really no mentors to speak of. And so anyway, my early years of elk hunting were flailing at best. And then after I graduated from high school, ended up working in a sawmill and working with a guy that was a bow hunter. And it was like 1997. And I was bitching about rifle hunting for elk. And, you know, I'd rifle hunted for elk like 3 or 4 years and never even seen an elk during season, you know. And he's like, well, borrow my bow and go out in September and see what you find. And that's literally what he just handed me, this vintage golden eagle, I think is what it was called. A big old boat anchor of a bow, but it was a recurve. A compound, sorry.
Gotcha.
And anyway, that's kind of where it started for me. That very first year, I went out and I shot a bull. And I lost it, but I shot it. And I'm knowing what I know today, like, I know that bull died. There's a lot of things to bow hunting for elk and or any animal for that matter that is not like rifle hunting, and I didn't know those things.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, my early career was super challenging and had lots of experiences and, you know, up close encounters, and I lost a couple of bulls. And then I went on this campaign to sort of keep people from going through what I went through, you know, because I started without any mentors and didn't have any experience. And there wasn't a lot back then. There wasn't a lot of literature on the subject of, you know, how to type stuff for bow hunting. In fact, I learned to call for elk with an old Larry D. Jones cassette tape. Played it in my pickup, you know, on the way to work kind of deal. And so there wasn't a lot, you know, there no YouTube, you know, no classes that you could pay to go to learn. I think our the first round of that was the Primos videos. You know, some of those guys, they do tours around the nation and talk about how they call for elk.
Right. And
that was your best experience and your best upper hand was going to one of those seminars.
You know, I sat in quite a few of those.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the guy's name.
Wayne Carlton was the guy for me that I learned a lot from originally, not just elk calling. Actually, he taught me a lot about bear hunting too, which was interesting, calling bears and stuff. But I remember going to sit into those seminars, and every year right before elk season, they would have a couple here in Arizona, and like local guys like Steve Chappell and whatever would do them, and I'd go to all those.
Yeah. And so that's how we learned back in the day. Mm-hmm. That and the School of Hard Knocks, you know, just one hard lesson after another, you know, one failed attempt after another. And started, you know, I was my favorite thing to say is I'm a great elk hunter. I'm not a good elk killer. Mm. And, you know, I struggled with actually sealing the deal. My second year I shot one and killed it. And that was my first bull elk. And I was hooked, you know, became my life's passion. But what I was trying to do was, you know, the biggest part of elk hunting is the actual recovery after you shoot one, you know, trying to find it. And there's just a lot of lessons I felt like I could have learned early on without that loss and heartache. So I joined an organization called Oregon Bow Hunters Association and got involved and got on the board and was actually trying to campaign to make it mandatory bow hunter education in Oregon.
Oh, okay.
And just, you know, unless so a lot of people look at that like, oh, you're making me do this and I don't want to. And for me, it was more like, no, you should do this because it's going to save you a lot of heartache in the long run. And we don't.
Right.
We don't know as much as we think we know. You know, we don't know what we don't know, right?
Right.
So that led to a long career. So I actually started with them in 2008. I started bow hunting in 97. It was 98 or 99 when I started volunteering for Oregon Bow Hunters.
Okay.
And anyway, that, you know, started that course and, you know, did a lot of good things. But I never got that pushed through. I could just never get enough buy-in from the community to make that happen.
It's a tough thing, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's kind of what started my career. And, you know, we saw some success through the years. It was limited. And then, you know, kind of a little side story. It was like the switch for me. I call it the switch. Is I think it was 2007. We started, me and some buddies, they're born and raised outdoors. We started Born and Raised Outdoors. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that was because we watched the Primos videos, full circle to Primos. And we watched these Primos videos and we're like, man, that's not reality. Like, we don't pass up 350 inch bulls. Like, you know, we're on public ground and, you know, with 5,000 other bow hunters in Oregon, and you get a chance to shoot a spike and it's legal, you're going to shoot that spike, you know? And, so we thought it was a good idea to buy a camera and start our own video production company. And none of us had any experience of any of that. In 97, we got our first camera, like 2 weeks before season, I think it was. And we didn't even know where the power button was. It was like foreign object to us. But that kind of started us down the path of, you know, reality, so to speak. And I think it was that first year I hunted with a buddy's dad. It was actually Trent Fisher. You know, he's still one of the born and raised guys. And I was hunting with Trent's dad, and we were in Western Oregon, and we're on this herd of elk, and we're, you know, doing the hot pursuit thing, and got right in the middle of them and got in this little patch of timber, and I caught up with Daryl, was his name, Daryl Fisher. We call him Papa Fisher. And he had just shot a bull, and I walked up behind him and, you know, hey, did you hit him? He's like, yeah. And we could hear more elk coming down the hill in the timber to us. And he's like, yeah, get ready. And I look up, and this spike pops out on this little skid road that we're on. And I'm just standing there. I don't have an arrow knocked. I'm not ready to kill it. I just look at it, and it stands there for what seems forever. And finally it ran off, and he turns around and looks at me. He's like, what are you doing? I was like, I don't know. Because why didn't you shoot it? I'm like, I don't know. He puts his hand on my shoulder and he goes, you know, if you want to kill something, you got to kill it.
Right.
Like you've got to have that mindset. And for me, that was the pivotal moment. I think it was probably 5 years. It had been like 5 years since I'd actually killed a bull. And so for me, it was like a switch. I'm like, you're right. If you want to kill something, you have to have that mentality. It has to be your first and foremost goal. So, you know, at the time, what I kind of rehearsed what went through my head was I didn't want to move because this elk popped out on the road and he was looking at us. And if I moved, he'd like run away, you know.
Right.
And I kind of ran the whole scenario back in my head. And so in all reality, I should have had an arrow knocked. And as soon as he popped out, I should have drawn and shot him because he was only 20 yards.
Right. Dumb. Exactly.
So later in that season, I got another opportunity, and I remember Trevor and I were up to bat, and this bull, the team was calling this bull up the hill, and he was coming right to us. And I always had a habit of like trying to get hidden and, you know, not be exposed and try to have the perfect scenario. And Trevor and I were talking. He's like, we need to hide. And I'm like, nope, I'm not hiding this time. I'm going to kill this bull. And I jumped up on a stump. Like I'm sticking out like a sore thumb. You know, I jumped up on a stump, and this bull's coming through the reprod. I don't know if your listeners know what reprod is, but, or what we call it anyway.
It's, yeah. At least I do. I think it's a common term, hopefully.
Yeah. It's that where they've logged a unit and then replanted it, and it's pretty thick. And this stuff is like 12 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And then there would be some openings, you know, it's Western Oregon elk hunting is super tough, really close encounters usually. But I jumped up on the stump because it's like, I'm not getting shot if I can't see him. So I jumped up on the stump, and he come out at like 30 yards. I drew back and just shot him like it was easy, you know?
Right.
And for me, that moment in time and that experience with Papa Fisher was the pivotal moment in my elk hunting career. If you want to kill them, you got to have that mindset to kill them. That has to be your number one goal. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I switched tactics this past couple of years, but I went 14 years straight of killing at least one bull with my bow.
Wow. That's
starting,
awesome.
Starting on that day. And, that's something that I try to tell people. It's super hard to convey, you know, cause it's a mindset, but you have to have a killer instinct. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way you're going to be consistently successful, is having that killer instinct. And some people don't have it. You know, it can be learned, I think, but just some people don't have it.
Yeah. I feel like you can learn how to, like, I don't know, get control of your, you know, your mind and your emotions. But having that killer instinct, I think it's an instinct. It's part of you. It's like,
yeah,
I don't know about you, but it's like, I don't get buck fever, whatever, bull fever in this instance, until afterwards. Are you the same way?
Yeah, it wasn't originally that way though.
Okay.
You know, those first few years I'd get pretty damned excited beforehand, and that, you know, and even today there's times where I have to talk myself off the ledge. If I start getting a little, if I have too much time to think about things, I can get up on that ledge and start shaking, and I can usually talk myself off of it. And a lot of that's just experience at this point, where I know when I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. And I know how to talk myself back down off of it, but that just comes over years of, you know, experiences and encounters. But
yeah, I don't know. Yeah, now, for me, like, I feel like when I go into like a kill mode, like this mode, like it's almost like sometimes it's to my detriment, because like things on the periphery kind of go almost hazy. And I'm very like laser focused, and that's why I've killed the wrong animal, because I don't even see antlers. Like I know there's antlers there, but I don't like see them. So I've shot smaller or sometimes just different animals than I was originally intending to. And I don't know. I get this like crazy tunnel vision, and it's served me well many times, but I think sometimes it also, you know, causes me to rush things. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, maybe. I mean, I get that laser focus for sure. That's the only thing on your mind is I'm killing this animal. That's what's happening, mm-hmm. you know? So I get that laser focus. It's when I have too much, like there's the past couple of years, I've kind of switched tactics. I'll get back to my history here, but
okay, yeah, sorry.
I kind of went down this rabbit hole, but I've kind of switched tactics. Like early on was a lot about calling, and it still is about calling, but I've moved over to western or eastern Montana and gotten into some of this more open country, and it's different way to hunt, and so I've changed my tactics a little bit. And the last few bulls I've shot have been finding them in their bed, and like mule deer style, and stalking on them and then waiting for them to stand up. Mm. And my record for standing there in one place is 7 hours.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So in that 7 hours, a lot of things go through your head, you know, like you get excited, the bull starts to move around, you think he's going to stand up, or, you know, there's just so much time to mess with your own mind, you know. But, you know, early on when we're calling elk in and that sort of thing, like that wasn't as much of an issue because mm-hmm. shit happens so fast.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But a little bit more about my history is I volunteered for Oregon Bow Hunters for like 7 or 8 years. And then I was self-employed in the logging industry. And in 2008, when everything crashed, I had this little logging outfit. There was like three of us. And in 2008, when everything crashed, I was pretty much stuck with no work, and I had to get a job and pay my, you know, at least pay my house payment. And I ended up getting lucky and getting on board with Oregon Hunters Association and working for them as their chapter coordinator.
Oh, cool.
And, the pay wasn't great, but I was super passionate about it and loved the work and loved the people. And so I did that for 8 years. And then in my work, I spent a lot of time at the Capitol working mm-hmm. with legislators and, you know, working for the Game and Fish Department, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is what it's called. And I just saw the writing on the wall, the politics in Oregon. And this was back in 2014, mm-hmm. 15. And I just, you know, I'd spent some time in Montana and spent some time in Wyoming and Idaho through the years. And I'm like, man, there's better places to live. And my wife was originally from Montana.
Okay.
So we both kind of landed on moving to Montana. And so I started that path and ended up getting a job with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers and early on in their youthfulness. And so that moved me to Missoula, Montana.
Okay.
And that was in 2015. So that's kind of brings me pretty close to up to speed. I worked for them for about 6 years, 7 years. And then my family and I decided to combine our efforts, and we started a bison ranch from scratch.
Nice.
Over here in central, south central Montana. We're just south of Billings. So we started a bison ranch in 2000. We started the process in 2019. And we're now 3 years on the ranch that we bought, and herd's grown and everything. And so I took a year off after I, from BHA, and took a year off and got the bison ranch up on its feet. And then this last year I jumped back into conservation, and I'm the executive director for Montana Wild Sheep Foundation now. So
that's awesome.
That's spent the last 20 some odd years, 24 or 5 years in hunting and conservation, which has been amazing. It's been awesome. So it's kind of a little history of my professional background, but I often find myself thinking to myself that the only thing I'm really good at in life is elk hunting, and that's only because I've really dedicated my life to elk hunting, you know, inadvertently. And I don't know, you know, it's more through the passion of it than anything else. But you know, it's like any successful athlete or business person, you know, if you dedicate your life to it, and like, and just immerse yourself in it, you're going to get better at it.
Right.
You know,
100%. I forgot what the statistics were, how many hours it takes you to become an expert at something. But you know, it just kind of boils down to that scenario, which is where you're, the more time and effort and willingness to be immersed in something, that, you know, the better and faster you're going to become an expert or a top contender in that field.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think to that point, like it's hard for people to grasp, you know, but back when we were doing the born and raised thing early on, you know, that was all year round. Mm-hmm. We were either elk hunting, you know, like 30 days was one of the DVDs that we put out, and it was 30 days. That's how long the season was. And every one of us hunted 30 days, like every single day of that season we hunted. If it was after work, you know, leaving early on Friday, you get a 4-day weekend, like that sort of thing. But it was every day we elk hunted. And when it wasn't season, we were planning for the next elk hunt. And if we weren't planning for it, we were talking about it. And, you know, so still today, like a lot of my life revolves around planning and executing elk hunting, you know, and just being in the woods. So that's where some people are, you know, they've got a week out of the year.
Right.
And that's what they dedicate to elk hunting, or maybe it's a few weekends here or there. And I'm not talking down on that.
No, I mean, everybody's got a different life, right?
Yeah. But it's, you know, your level of passion and dedication are going to have a factor into the outcome of your success.
Sure. Absolutely. You know? We have that. We've been having this conversation for a long time. And it originally started actually with my buddy Charles some time ago on my podcast. I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. We're talking about, you'll ask a person, you'll say, you know, how many years? Oh, I've been hunting for 20 years. And then you kind of dive into it a little bit more, and it turns out, yeah, they've been hunting 20 years, but it's 7 days of hunting every year. And you're like, okay, so that's, you know, 20 times 7, 140 days. And you're like,
right.
Then you look at somebody, and at the time when we were having this conversation, I was doing like 75 days a year, 75, maybe 90 days a year in the field. And then there's guys that are in the field like 260 days a year, you know?
Right.
And,
yeah.
And it all boils down to experience and what you were saying earlier. It's like, yeah, okay. So why is it? That's why you had that guy that's been hunting for 5 years. That's just, it seems like he's a phenom or she's a phenom. But the fact of the matter is, it's just because they're immersed in it. They're spending that much time doing it. And if you spend that much time doing anything, you're going to get better at it, you know, and start making leaps and bounds ahead of people. So, yeah, it's not, it's not rocket science, you know. The more time you spend doing something, the better you're going to be at it. Simple as that. But
and that's that. I mean, that's why, you know, through our born and raised years, you know, that we were successful because of that. There was a couple of elements there, but you know, we just freaking hunted hard, mm-hmm. and you know, pounded ground and did a lot of my. We weren't better than anybody else. In fact, at the time we started, we were still all rookies.
Yeah.
You know, but that first year we tagged out and there was five of us, I think, mm-hmm. Four of us, how many ever it was. And we tagged out, but the contributing factors there were number one, we hunted super hard, like really hard. Mm-hmm. And then number two, we worked together. You know, we work to help each other be successful.
Yeah.
And through all of my time with the crew there, like that's why we were successful, because it wasn't, you know, when it came down, there were other issues, but when it came down to hunting and killing elk, mm-hmm. It was all about the team effort, and whoever was up, like everybody did their part to make sure that person was successful. And by up, I mean the shooter.
Right.
You know,
yep.
You got a caller, a shooter, and a cameraman, you know, kind of scenario, but, everybody was on the bandwagon to get that person a shot and help them kill an elk. And so I've seen that in, I've hunted with other people here and there throughout time. And that isn't always the case. And some people get greedy and some people want to be the hero. And
sure.
Usually that doesn't end up well.
Right. You know, and if when it, I could see both sides of that too. You know, if you're only going hunting for a week, it's hard. When you're hunting the whole season and you know that there's going to be more opportunities and so on and so forth, like it's easy to be a little bit more selfless and want to be a part of the team effort, you know? But when you're on a 7-day hunt or whatever, and you got three guys that got to tag out, that's when you start seeing the every man for themselves type situation a lot more frequent. Mm-hmm. So, but the one good thing about hunting with a close knit group of guys is, like we were talking about that experience thing, you start learning from each other's mistakes too. Like you pick up, I think the learning curve gets even shortened even further, because you're going back and forth between each other and you're learning from what each other's experiences were. Oh, you know, I was over on this ridge and the bull did this and I did this and blah, blah, blah. And you start, you know, all those things start kind of like, if you're paying attention, start helping you become better. Cause I even noticed even myself, like just doing this podcast for freaking Jesus, almost 20 years, 19 years or something like that. Now I've talked to so many people and I've heard so many experiences that some of those experiences I'm able to recall on myself and kind of use them as a tool to be better in situations that I've never been faced with or whatever. So,
which is probably much how your listeners feel, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess that's why it's a popular thing to listen to podcasts, learn, right? It definitely shortens the learning curve. So yeah, it's not just about tips and tactics. I find that the people that learn how to listen to like a store guy who's telling a story or a girl who's telling a story and pick the things away from that they need to implement in their own situation, or at least have those experiences to recall on, you know, those are the people that do really well. And that's why I kind of always like to mix up stories with you know, the straight tactics thing.
But, yeah. Yeah. I think that it's hard, because my number one thing is if anybody tells you that this is how it is and that's how it is and that's how it's going to be, mm-hmm. and it's the all end all, like they're not somebody you should listen to.
Right.
And I say that, you know, because I don't care how long you've been elk hunting or deer hunting or any kind of hunting, there's always going to be, you know, change. Like there's always,
there's no absolutes for sure.
Yeah. There's no absolutes. And that's the only absolute. Like it's always going to be different. And I think one of the biggest mistakes made in the woods is guys have a tendency to overthink things. And, you know, there are some absolutes, or there's some, not absolutes, but there are some things that are like, if you do this, this is going to happen. Like, if an elk smells you, it's probably over, you know?
Yeah.
Not 100%, but it's probably like 95% that you're done. But for all intensive purposes, like, things change, and you overthink things. And at the end of the day, they're a wild animal and they do remember things, but in the short term, you know, so it's, overthinking things has saved a lot more elk than it's killed.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's switch gears here a little bit. I'm going to throw a couple questions at you that we got, sent to us, and, they're kind of generic and generalized here. So we'll try to get a little bit more specific on them. I know that you've hunted several different states for elk. What are some of the things you're looking for to pick an area? And then once you get there, what are you doing with it?
A lot of variables there, you know, but, sure. You know, is it a draw tag? Is it over the counter tag? There's a lot of variables, but I usually try to, you know, if it's a draw tag, this is a little different, but if it's an over the counter tag, it's always a year in advance planning. And I always, how I try to narrow down a location. One of the main factors is like overall population. Mm-hmm. One of the secondary factors is success rate. You know, a lot of states, you can look that information up,
sure,
online. And then predators, you know, predators is becoming a thing, like wolves. Like I used to look at wolves a lot more than I do now, because wolves are pretty much everywhere now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, predation is a pretty big thing. I tried to dig up as much information on that as I can. And then, you know, what's the terrain like? And then you start narrowing it down to logistics. Like, can I even get there? And if I can get there, can I get an elk out? Without it spoiling, kind of scenario, you know.
Sure.
So that usually, if you know, look for a, and I don't necessarily always look for a high success rate, but if I'm going out of state and I'm going to spend the money,
mm-hmm,
and the time to be, you know, away from my family or, you know, outside of my own state elk hunting, I look for like how many 6 points are killed in this unit. Cause I'm not going to spend, you know, $2,000, $1,500 to go shoot a spike.
Right.
And so I'm like, okay, how many 6 points are killed in this unit? And that doesn't necessarily mean I won't shoot a 5 point, but that means that if there's a high number of 6 points killed in this unit, you can expect to have an opportunity at some bigger bulls, 6 point bulls or whatever, you know.
Sure.
It's not the driving factor, but it's definitely one of my, you know, top three or four things that I look at.
Gotcha.
You know, just because I want to get some of my value again, I'll shoot a 5 point. Like, that's not out of the question, but I try to put my career has changed. My mindset has changed over my career. Elk hunting career has been that if I put myself in an area where there are big bulls,
mm-hmm,
then my chance of killing a big bulls is higher.
Of course. Right. Like, right.
Yeah. Kind of common sense. But spent a lot of time in my early days of just hunting wherever we could find elk. And honestly, back then, it was 100% more about the meat than it was, you know, killing a mature bull. And so I've kind of changed over the years as my reasons and how I execute things. But
sure,
those, you know, area and then ability to get in and out of there, and then predation and all of those. And that'll help narrow it down. And usually what I do is I look at several units and then start narrowing it down. It's like, maybe I'm looking at six different units, and then I start breaking each of those six different units down. And pretty soon I'll end up with, you know, the top two, like they'll rise to the surface pretty quick.
Like, what's the criteria that you're using to break down those remaining units? Or your initial units, I should say.
You know, so I don't like people. So yep. I'll try to find, you know, more remote country if I can. You know, I like to hunt backcountry as much as possible. I don't like roads necessarily, but the criteria are like numbers of elk. Are there elk there? Mm-hmm. Is there a good number of elk there? And then back to that 6 point thing, like, are there mature bulls being killed there? How many hunters are there? That's, you know, those are kind of the top three. How many hunters actually hunt these units or this unit? And then those are really the top three things, you know.
Gotcha.
Remoteness, numbers of elk, numbers of hunters. So I guess top four things. Numbers of hunters, and then what is the population like? Are they mature animals? Are they getting to grow? Because if there's not a lot of 6 points being killed, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of elk, that usually means there's a lot of pressure. Mm. And they're getting killed young.
Gotcha.
If there's some 6 points being killed and, you know, there's still a fair number of elk there, that means they're able to escape. You know, there's some escapement going on and they're able to get some age on them.
Mm. Yeah. So you mentioned predation a couple times. What are, aside from the numbers, have you noticed, or why are you looking at predation? What do you think the effect is of having wolves in a unit versus not, or what, like, where are some of the things you're looking at?
So wolves specifically, I mean, there's all kinds of predation, right? There's bears, sure. There's cougar cats, the two-legged, which is the pressure,
right?
So for me, wolves, you know, and I didn't get to hunt Idaho or Montana or Wyoming pre-wolf introduction, right? Okay. So I don't know what it was like, you know, back in the mid-90s before the wolves, you know, had their major impact on the populations. And so I don't, you know, I can't compare that to what we have today. But what I do know is, you know, what we do have today, like, there are elk, they're out there, they're living with the wolves. What I know about the wolves in hunting areas where there never were wolves is that they have an impact on their behavior. Mm-hmm. And wolves definitely have an impact on their breeding, and they have an impact on their, and I'm coming from primarily a bow hunter standpoint here. Cause this last year is the first time I ever killed an elk with my rifle.
Oh, wow.
And I killed two. One was in Arizona, actually.
Oh, nice.
But the wolves will affect their behavior. Like, it'll shut a herd up. It'll shut elk up. Like, they'll quit talking.
Mm-hmm.
They'll move. They'll move to, like, really nasty country. An example, I was hunting elk in Idaho. And, you know, we were hunting this big drainage, this big basin. And the first couple of days was on fire. And a lot of times what we'll do is we'll move some, you know, we'll put pressure on a couple of herds. And if we're like the only ones in there, we'll put, you know, we'll try to kill one and give that a few days. And if things aren't panning out, we're going to pull out and move to another drainage.
Mm.
Maybe we'll go back, maybe we won't. But we'd been hunting this drainage and all of a sudden the elk were just gone. We couldn't find them anywhere. So we pulled out. Regrouped, went back in, and I went into like the next basin, like two or three basins over. But while we were out, we were like grabbing fuel at the gas station, and we ended up talking to this old boy that was in there elk hunting too. And he told us where he was at, which was like one drainage from where we just left. And he's like, oh yeah, the wolves moved through here. And man, they were howling the last two nights and they were in here thick.
Mm.
So we kind of all looked at each other like, that makes sense. We kind of assumed that those wolves moved into the drainage we were in, started putting pressure on the elk, and the elk just started bumping drainages and moved them. And so we went into where we would assume the elk would go, which was the steepest, gnarliest, nastiest, crappiest country in there, thinking that, you know, elk try to get away from the wolves by getting in those steep country. And sure enough, that's where they were at. And I found the same thing to be true in Oregon. I got to go hunt Oregon in the Eagle Caps.
Okay.
And hunted in there that first year that muzzleloader season came to be in the Eagle Caps. And the damn elk were where the billy goats were.
Yeah.
And those wolves had been in the caps for, you know, 4 or 5 years at that point. Gotcha. And the elk were not in the valley bottoms. They weren't in the nice north facing timbered faces, you know, and they were up in the rocks in the steepest, gnarliest country you could find where the billy goats live. So that's, you know, I take all that into consideration. If number one, if there's a lot of wolves in there, I really don't want to hunt there necessarily. I mean, if I have to, I will. But if I can find a place where there are fewer wolves, that's what I'll look at. But when I'm there, if there are wolves there, I also take that, the stories I just gave, into consideration that if you're hunting where you think elk should be and they're not there, mm-hmm. and there are wolves there, start looking in the country where the sheep and goats should be, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Steep, gnarly, bluffy stuff that helps them escape the wolves.
I've experienced that myself. Actually, just recently, last year, I seen quite a bit of that. We were in Idaho, and I was going in the dark, walking up this basin, and I was bugling, locating and bugling, walking and moving. You know, just kind of walking my way in the dark, and freaking, I bugled and some wolves howled below me, and I was like, oh, okay. First, it was a little unnerving because I was by myself, but no firearm either.
Right.
But this basin always had elk in it, you know, and then I found the elk way, way up high, like above tree line. And it was, I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, oh, these wolves must have pushed them all the way up there.
Yeah.
But there was literally, like you said, billy goats up there. So,
yeah. Yeah. And it changes their vocalization. Like, they kind of shut up.
Yeah. It's a lot, it's not as constant or hot and heavy. You know, they might respond, but it's like a one thing. Hey, we're over here. Shut the hell up.
Yeah. And then you have to be right on top of them to make it happen again. And
yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So I try to look for areas where there's fewer of them, you know, like grizzly bears, they're everywhere now. So it's, you know, people say, oh, I don't want to hunt where the grizzly bears are. And, well, good luck, you know, going to Arizona.
Once every 15 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So I haven't had a tag here in freaking forever. And the last tag I had was a late season archery tag. It wasn't even a rut hunt. Yeah, it's ridiculous trying to get a tag in Arizona or Nevada or Utah. But
yeah, so you probably don't want to hear that I drew the first year I applied.
You know what, dude? It happens all the time. And the way what unit did you draw?
5B.
Oh, that's my unit too.
Late rifle.
It's my favorite unit. I love. Okay, it's, late rifle. Okay, that makes sense. So there's quite a bit of tags in that.
Hunt. There's a lot of tags.
So there's a lot of tags available for the random draw. Was what you got? You got a random tag.
Yeah, we got it in random. Yep.
Yeah. So, and I tell people that all the time. Like, if you just want to go hunting, look. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's look at the units that have a lot of tags, because then you have a mathematical chance of drawing. Because if I talk about this with sheep all the time. Like, I'm like, you're putting in for a unit that only has two tags, right? Or only has one tag. Well, they're only giving that one tag to residential or a resident. They're not giving it to a non-resident.
Right.
You know, and if there's two, technically, there might not even be a tag for with just two. So, like, because it's like 10% of the tags go to the non-residents, or 11%. I think it's 11%. But so you can't physically draw it unless you got to look at those things. You got to look at those.
There's
things.
Not even a tag available. And right. Yeah, you see that a lot. Non-residents putting in for specifically.
Yeah, that's the best unit. But
there's not even a tag available when you're putting in for that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, since we kind of started going down this line of discussion, let's talk about extremely pressured elk. What are some of the things you are doing to either elicit response or even just create an opportunity for yourself to get an elk in these high pressured units or high pressured areas?
Yeah, you know, it's situational, right? Like, depends on if you're bow hunting or if you're rifle hunting.
Well, let's talk bow hunting, and you can give us a scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's totally different than that late. Because there was a lot of people in that late rifle.
Yeah, that late rifle tag is could be a shit show.
Yeah, but high pressured elk, they're definitely difficult, but not impossible. And so it just depends, and we're talking about bow hunting here, but it just depends on the ground, the habitat. Are they in thick, steep, timbered country? Are they in, the Montana's plains country, the sagebrush, that sort of thing? Mm-hmm. But I honestly just try to get away from people most of the time, even in the high pressured areas. Mm-hmm. Like, there are pockets where people aren't going, and I'll probably call less and use my glass more. So, try to locate them and treat it more like a deer hunt, mm-hmm. so to speak. Try to glass them up, try to get in close. I'll still call, but I'll usually wait till I know that the time's right. And usually that's when, you're in close. And, a lot of people say, man, I called and they just ran the other way. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of things happening there. And again, this is my opinion. This is my school of hard knocks education opinion. Either, number one, you're a shitty caller and you don't sound like an elk, and they know the difference.
Right.
Or you're not, you're not in that zone there, the bubble, we call it. You're just far enough out that the elk feels the bull. We're going to specifically target the bull. If he's got cows, there's lots, like all these different scenarios we could talk about all day long, but your general scenario is a bull's got some cows, you're trying to kill him. If you're outside of his bubble, he's going to pick up his cows and leave, even if you're a good caller.
Right.
That's the likelihood of happening is that.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't want a confrontation. So,
right. Right.
It's, if you get close enough, usually you're close enough that he feels like he doesn't have an option.
Doesn't have a choice. And
right.
I always relate this because we're men and we've been through this or witnessed this scenario is, when you're 21, 22 and you go to a bar and you've hitting on this lady, or maybe you got your girlfriend there and then some drunk guy's like yelling at you from across the room or whatever, smarting off. And you're like, yeah, whatever. And so you can ignore that.
Right.
But if you're standing or sit at the bar or sitting at your table and the guy's standing at your table or sitting at the bar next to you, you can no longer ignore that,
Exactly.
And something's going to happen, right, wrong, or indifferent. Like, this guy's in your face, so you got to do something. And that's the same thing with an elk. When you're in their bubble, when you're sitting next to him or, and that distance varies depending on terrain and features and, but
I was going to ask you what you thought the bubble was. What was that distance? But
for me, it's always like inside 80 yards. Mm-hmm. It's like 80 yards ish, depending on if you have terrain. If you have cover, if you got some, whatever. If they can't see you,
spoken like a yards, true Oregon guy,
right?
Because you say that to a guy in Arizona, and you say inside 80 yards, you're like, if I'm at 80 yards, I'm shooting,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, exactly. I called a bull like 600 yards away in this open sagebrush in eastern Montana. But I could never have gotten 80 yards from him for sure. So, like I said, it just varies, but. So to that point, like if it's open terrain, mm-hmm. you can't call it 200 yards if they can see you. Right.
Right.
So
yeah,
it's completely different. But if you're hunting timbered country and you can get within 80 yards and it's always a bugle for me. It's, mm-hmm. I'll throw some cow calls in there. It's always that try to make them think that a bull's trying to grab a cow and take it from his herd. Mm-hmm. That always pisses them off. But you're basically trying to insult them. You're trying to insult their ego. And get them pissed off, get them riled up so they can't think straight. And once they're mad, you can get away with a lot of things, mm-hmm. you know. But back to the high-pressured elk thing, like, that's difficult to do if they've been called at for 2 weeks and been bumped by three different guys. And, you know, they tend to not forget that stuff in the short term. So it's just, you know, the situation. Same thing with that open country scenario. You know, if they've been pressured and they've been bumped around, you're better off trying to use your stalking skills than your calling skills.
Right.
And just, and a lot of times in that country, I'll just sit on them and wait for them to make a mistake. Mm-hmm. You know, I've sat on elk for days. And then when I did get close enough, you know, I've stood there for hours, you know, 7 hours. I don't know if I said this already.
Yeah, you said that earlier. That's crazy.
Yeah. 7 hours is my record. And I don't want to do that again. It wasn't that fun.
No.
It wasn't that great.
No.
But you know, it's a lot like, becomes a lot like a mule deer scenario. And that area that I did that was a high pressure area. Like, there was a lot of guys in there.
Gotcha. When you say 7 hours, you were sitting, you were waiting for it to stand up for 7 hours, like you were within bow range of the.
I started at 80 yards, uh-huh. and the clock started ticking, and I slowly inched my way up. Took me about an hour and a half to get within 40 yards.
Okay. Jesus.
And
40 yards, yeah. for 7 hours.
And I stood there for, you know, like 6 hours at 40 yards. You know, and I was super lucky because the wind never changed. And the wind was blowing decent, but I had the wind right, and it stayed that way the entire time, which is like a unicorn.
Yeah.
It worked out that time. And the time before that, I talking about the bubble, mm-hmm. you know, and I the biggest bull I ever shot was here in eastern Montana, and I knew he was in this general area, and there was this plateau with all these kind of westerly fingers that come off this main ridge, and the only timber on the entire area was on the north side of these little fingers. Mm. Man, it was hot, you know, and so I'm like, they've got to be bedded in this timber somewhere. And so I was just trying to locate him. So I was bugling, and I went on and hit every one of these dang fingers. And I came to the very last finger, the smallest one. It was like the one I least expected there to be an elk in. But I thought, you know, hey, there's a chance that this is where they're at. And so I walked up to the edge that overlooked this little finger. And right before I walked up, I bugled two or three times and nothing. It was crickets, like nothing. Mm. And this is about noon. And so I'm like, well, they must not be in there either. So I was going to walk up to the edge and sit down, take my pack off and eat lunch and then go back to the drawing board. And as I'm walking up to the edge, I look across, it's 80 yards across. I look across this other side and into the timber, and I see an elk. Mm. And I just freeze and pull up my binoculars, and it was a cow. And this bull got up at the same time. This bull got up, walked down, he got up out of the brush, circled around and bedded down in the wide open. He pushed this cow out of her bed and took her bed.
Oh, God.
And so I crept up a little closer, and I stood there. And it was like 80 degrees and the wind was blowing. It was hot. I was standing out in the open sun, and I stood there for 3 hours before he finally stood back up and gave me a shot, and I shot him and killed him. But I called it 100 yards, a little over 100 yards, and he didn't say a peep. And I know he heard me. Like, I know he heard.
Yeah. But that's that time of day though, man. Noon, sometimes, especially when it's hot. I see that all. So one of the, you know, people talk about Arizona being such an awesome, you know, haunt, whatever. And what they don't realize is it's an awesome hunt till about 10:30 in the morning.
Right.
And then, I mean, you can be riding on its back bugling and it's not going to make a peep. Like, they just, because it's so, you know, it's hot. You talk about 80 degrees. I mean, shit, 80 degrees is nice. You know, we'll have 90, 95, you know, at 7,000-8,000 feet of elevation.
Yeah.
And they won't fire up until, like, you know, an hour before dark. So it's a crappy thing about, you know, hunting in Arizona is that, like, man, they read the script, they play the rule, they play the game, they bugle their brains out in the morning and all night long. But then that middle of the day, no action at all. But, you know, if you go to Montana or Idaho or shit, almost anywhere else, New Mexico's like Arizona, but it's pretty much similar situation, hot and dry. I think Nevada's the same too. I haven't hunted elk there, but I've hunted deer and I've had interactions with plenty of elk there. But, you know, you go to these Idaho, Oregon, whatever, Washington, Colorado, you can get a response in the middle of the day. I mean, you're very, 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 very hard pressed to get a response middle of the day here.
Yeah.
I have, but it takes some serious trickery to make it happen.
Right. And every bull's different. Like, we play this like every bull's the same, but sure, they're not. You know? And back, you know, I mean, well, even now, if I'm hunting elk that are, you know, actively talking, you know, it's always the one that doesn't stop bugling that we go after. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always the one we target. And that bull's different than the whatever, six other bulls that are in the area. You know, he's the one that's either A, it's just his personality, he's just mouthy, mm-hmm, or B, he's just wound up. And either way, you have the highest odds of killing that bull that bugles.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the right temperature. It's the right, you know, situation for sure.
Yeah. I think one more, before we get off the subject of high pressure elk, I think one more thing that we do is just freaking keep hunting hard. Like, just keep going. Mm-hmm. I don't go back to camp, or, you know, I don't quit hunting. You know, I just, and again, I'm not talking about Arizona. When it's 90 some degrees, I don't hunt. I'll take a nap under a tree or whatever.
I switch. I go to sit on a water hole or something. I have like a plan. I'm going to chase bugles in the morning, and then I'm going to eventually find myself in an area, and then I'm going to go sit on the closest water or set myself in an area where I have a feeling they're going to, you know, it's the coolest, darkest area where they're going to come in and bed or something like that. I just changed my tactics. I just don't, you know.
Yeah.
I don't go back to camp anymore. I used to do the go to back to camp thing quite often. I don't find myself doing that anymore.
Yeah, I don't. I've never been in that camp.
Yeah.
it's always on my back or, you know, whatever, but it's just all this in, and a lot of guys, you know, and it just depends. If I've got a lot of time and there's only two of us hunting and we're trying to kill a big bull or whatever, like, I'll play the patience game a little more, mm-hmm, or a lot more. But if I'm limited on days and there's a bunch of us, you know, there's three or four tags to fill, we're hunting every day. And, you know, you know that elk are going to typically in September be bedded in the dark timber on the north facing slope. General rule of thumb. They always break the rule every once in a while, but so we just go start pounding their bedding grounds. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's guys that play that patience game, like, well, I don't want to go into where they're bedded. Well, I've got 3 days to fill a tag, so I can't wait for them to just come back out. And like you said, you maybe have a couple hours in the morning, a couple hours in the evening, and that's not enough time to hunt.
No.
So we've killed a lot of bulls at noon.
Yeah.
A lot of bulls at noon because we chased them all morning. They went into their bedding area, gave them a little bit of a break, and then we went in their bedding area and started calling again, mm-hmm, and drug them out of their bed, and they came in and got shot.
Yeah.
You know, so we'll hunt all day long. And that's, you know, even in high pressure areas.
Yeah. For me, it's like almost like roosting a turkey. You know, well, they'll be bugling their heads off, and let's say I can't make it happen in the morning, but I'll kind of follow them into where they're going to bed. And then, I mean, it depends on where they're at. If they're in a position that we can sneak in on them and shoot them or whatever, great. But most of the time, I'll just hang tight within that, you know, 150 yards or whatever. And
yep.
And then wait for them to get up and then start working the calls and stuff again and make a play for that evening. So yeah, I kind of equate that to roosting a turkey, you know, but
yeah,
just following them into their bed and then work them once they're going to come out of bed again. But
we did that here, I don't know, two seasons ago, I think it was, two or three seasons. We were chasing this bull out of this canyon. He went up top of the ridge and down the north side, because he was on the south side in this big valley, and climbed his way out. And we chased him, and he went down one finger, and we followed him down that finger. And, you know, we knew he was going in there to bed, because it was a big timbered, steep, north-facing basin. And he got to a certain point where the wind was just wrong. We were going to get winded, so we backed out. He continued in. We circled around to get the wind right. Well, he went up the other side and ended up on the ridge on the other side of the basin. Mm. So we're like, well, shit. And then, you know, he bedded down and went silent. And we took a nap, ate some snacks, kind of waited for the wind to get right. And then as soon as that wind, you know, the prevailing wind changed, we circled back around, got up on very top of the ridge, and was circled above him. And it was like straight up 12 o'clock. I called him up out of his bed. You know, he was like 300 or 400 yards away. Called him up out of his bed, and he came almost running in.
Mm.
And we fouled it up and didn't kill him. But
oh, geez.
No shots fired, but he came into 20 yards. It was ridiculous. But
oh, Jesus.
It was a schmazel. But yeah, we pulled him right out of his bed. But we waited till the thermals got right and, you know, let him get a chance to get a little nap. You know, he slept for probably an hour and a half before we started calling. So, but yeah, it was good. Minus the not killing.
Yeah, well, whatever. That's nowadays, to me, the killing part's just icing on the cake.
Yeah.
Well, before I let you go, if you had to learn three elk vocalizations, what were those three elk vocal like, and learn and master, like you only had time to do that before you're going to go on an elk hunt and that's it and that's all, what were the three that you would do?
Well, bugle, right?
What kind of
bugles? My like number one. There's all kinds of different bugles, right? And I think part of the like there's more to this than
just of
calling,
course.
Right?
Sure.
It's one thing to master the calls. So let's master three calls. It's your, for me, it's the scream and the, you know, this screaming is like I said, you're trying to piss this elk off typically is what your goal is. And so you're trying to insult him. So if you know, bugle louder than him or bugle over the top of him, like those are tactics that are going to work. They're going to piss that elk off. But you know, you're scream and chuckle. Like if you can chuckle, I feel like chuckles are kind of underutilized. But
they're also the hardest part of the bugle to do, I think.
Yeah, it's super hard to do. So if you could master a chuckle, like you can screw up a bugle, to be honest with you. Like you don't have to sound like. Kind of go over this. A lot of people think, oh, you got to bugle like a small bull because you want to sound small. Well, some of the puniest bugles I have ever heard have come from some of the biggest bulls I've ever seen.
Sure.
So that just for me doesn't play out. Like it isn't, it's not, I don't want to say it's wrong, but it's for me is not as accurate as people think. So the bugle with the chuckle would be like my number one, like master that.
Mm-hmm.
If you got to learn one cult, if you got to learn three, you know, obviously all of them are great, but my second go-to is that calf. I won't say calf in distress, but like that hyper calf call.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a hyper cow call. with those three things, man, you can sure fool a lot of elk. I hate saying this out loud, especially a bunch of people. My number one go-to is that hyper calf. Just, I don't know, you know, I can only assume the psychology here. Because I see it happen in herds that I'm just watching, mm-hmm. you know, without human intervention. And it seems like when those calves get to jumping around and playing around and they're doing that hyper calf call, the whole herd kind of just goes to being elk. They lose, you know, they kind of let down their guard a little bit. Everybody gets wound up and excited. The cows start getting excited. And of course, then that excites the bulls. And everybody just kind of lets their guard down a little bit. And I've bumped bulls before where they, you know, they've seen me, maybe even smelt me. Like I've been smelt before and called bulls back in. Hmm. But using that hyper calf call, it just seems to calm those bulls down. They kind of let their guard down a little bit more and gives you just a little bit more of an edge. But I would say those are the top three. You know, and of course, then you throw in that hyper cow call and that just kind of sends them over the edge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I've been fortunate to be in some freaking amazing scenarios. One of them was in Idaho where it was just, you know, there's like a couple of days out of the season where these big herds combine, you know, there's 200 or 300 head of elk. They're all just, it's just a gigantic rut fest. And you know, I've been in the middle of it where elk will smell you and they'll run like 50 yards and then they just go back to doing what they were doing. they're just in such a frenzy that danger is put to the wayside. And those are magical moments in the elk woods, but all you can hear is those hyper calls,
right?
You know, of course, bulls bugling, and but those things stick out to me the most is like, what are they saying to each other? So that's the other part of it. Like, learn how to make those calls.
Yeah, but you gotta learn the language. Yeah,
yeah, learn how to say and what to say and how to say it. When to say it.
When to say it, yeah.
Those are harder for me to tell people. Like,
well,
harder,
yeah, because you got to like learn the situations. And you'd have to spend hours trying to give every kind of like, okay, when they do this, yep. And this is this, and the barometer's yep. this way.
Right.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's hard. It's hard.
Yeah. But it's hard to convey that piece, you know.
But what I say to that is paying attention when you're out there. And listening to what's going on, but not only listening to what's going on, but taking note of the situation, the conditions, and so on and so forth. That way, it gives you a better idea of what to say, when to say it. You know.
Yep. Yep. And I guess I'll leave on this. I got a story that I do want to tell because it's one of my most things I've conveyed to people mm-hmm. is. To be aggressive. Don't rest on your laurels. Like, just be super aggressive. There's been a lot more elk live by complacency, you know, than mm-hmm. aggressiveness. And a really good example of that is back in the born and raised days, we used to mountain bike in a lot. We mountain biked in and ended up getting on this bull first thing in the morning. And he was bugling and chasing his cows around, and it was big timber. And so we all snuck in there, and there were six of us there. And there was this bull and a couple other little raghorns. He was pretty nice. I forget if he was a 5-point or 6-point, but he was a nice Roosevelt.
Right.
And like three of us came to full draw within the first hour of, you know, the interaction with this bull. Nobody could execute a shot. Finally, he wins us. The whole herd wins us. They run off the top of this mountain. They run down into this drainage. So we give chase. We go down there, try to locate him again. Finally locate him again. He's, you know, a fair distance away. We go after him again. The first time we heard him bugle was like 7 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And we ended up chasing that same bull all day long. And we had 5 or 6 different close encounters couldn't, you know, three different shooters, you know, three different callers, two different cameramen, and kept after him and kept after him and kept after him. And like, I don't know, we're probably 4 miles, 5 miles later, we shot him at 5 o'clock in the evening. And we did that because we kept chasing him.
Right.
We did not let him, you know, we didn't like wait to see what he was going to do. We just kept pushing him. And it was, I mean, you could see like there was a switch. I remember, and it's, this is on film. I forget what video it's in, but you could hear the switch. Finally, at like 4:45 in the evening, he had had enough.
Yeah, they just get sick of it. He's like, all right.
He was so mad, and you could hear it in his bugle. Like, you could just tell his bugle changed, and he comes stomping in like he was going to kick somebody's ass, and we shot him.
Nice.
So I leave on that.
That's a good one. That's a good story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your knowledge with us and spending a little time.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It's been a while since I've got to chat about elk hunting.
Yeah. So you're not doing anything with Born and Raised anymore?
No, I haven't in several. Well, pretty much since I moved to Montana. They came here and hunted, and I forget what year it was, 2017 maybe, and I hunted with them in Hushin. Those guys, we hunted for 4 or 5 days together.
Nice.
That was the last time I got with them, but yeah.
Hell yeah.
Just busy. You know, life's busy.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of different things, and quite honestly, I've hunted last probably 4 or 5 years without a camera, and it's been pretty nice, to be honest.
It is nice. It's nice and it's not nice at the same time. I mean, I've got so used to having that other person with me that, you know, was there for me, you know? It's like,
yeah,
when because I had a TV show and all that, like I had a cameraman with me and he was there for me, you know? Like,
yeah,
it was like nice because that person wasn't hunting, but they were hunting with you. Like, it's like you had a built-in hunting buddy without, yeah.
And without the competition of the tag.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. Or without having to worry about filling another tag or whatever the case was, you know? But yeah. So parts of me I miss that. I also miss the fact of being able to go back and recall through the video. Like, now you're just relying on your memory and your, you know, it's nice to have that like video. Oh yeah, exactly. That's kind of how that went down. And
I do miss that. The recording of the event. I do miss that. And there have been some really cool things that have happened that, you know,
you wish you had.
I wished I had on film. You know, people say, "Oh, you're full of shit." I'm like, "Well, no, but I don't have the video to prove it." You know, kind of scenario.
It's not on video. Like, it didn't happen.
Right? Exactly. You know, and so I do miss that piece. And you know, if somebody was just following me around with a camera, I'd probably be okay with that.
Yeah,
but well, I find myself not wanting to run one as much.
Sure. Nowadays. I definitely don't want to do this self-film thing anymore. Oh my God, I can't stand that anymore.
It's so much work.
It's so much work, and I just like, so I don't want to carry any extra stuff and all this.
Right.
I've gotten very, as I'm getting older, I'm getting a lot more.
100%. So,
anyways.
100%. Yeah. You know, in the beginning of this, we were talking about remote areas, and I don't like to road hunt, but I do find myself in my older age trying to find flatter ground.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I get it. I get it.
I don't know how old you are.
48.
Yeah, we're the same age. Staring 50 down the barrel, brother.
Right. Yep.
I came to the realization last year that I got a lot more good years behind me than I do ahead of me. So
yeah, and that's shitty. That's scary. You've lived
kind of
more
scary.
Than...
It's a little scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But that that's why last year I came to that realization last year. My wife's fairly pissed at me, but I ended up getting a New Mexico landowner tag.
Mm-hmm.
My brother and I traded some bison meat for a landowner tag and hunted elk in Montana in September, then went to New Mexico in early October, and then went to Arizona in late December.
Nice.
all for elk.
Hell yeah. That's awesome.
Like, you know what? I couldn't afford it. I didn't have the time.
But you made it happen. You got it.
I could die tomorrow.
Yeah.
And screw it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't regret one day of it, you know?
I'm with you, man. I got similar mentality nowadays. So,
yeah.
Anyway,
hunt more, work less.
Yeah, exactly. I'd love to work less. That would be fantastic. Well, I feel like I'm working way more now than I ever have.
Yeah. So, definitely busy.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, John. All I right, appreciate buddy. It.
Thank you.
Hey, guys. Thanks for checking out the show. Really appreciate you. Keep those reviews and those comments coming. Helps us keep this free. Do me a favor, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Use promo code John Stallone to save 20%, all one word. And check out Howl for Wildlife. Thank you very much, and we'll catch you on the next show.